pledge to you that the cause of higher education at this institution and in this state would be my cause. With the support, the assistance, and the encouragement of you and the guidance of him who made us all, I am confident that this institution and all who give it life will satisfy to the fullest the highest expectations and the greatest demands that can be made upon this University of Florida.
Thank you, Mr. President. You please be seated, and the President will now give his inaugural address. Mr. President.
Thank you again, Chairman Ferguson. To all of you members of the Board of Regents, members of the Board of Education, all honored guests, faculty, staff, students, and all of you friends of this university, I add my personal welcome to those that's already been extended to you and express to each one of you my deepest appreciation and that of my family for your presence here today. To you, Tom Adams, to you, Dr. Crisp, to Presidents Taylor and President Henry, my gratitude for your kind, your reassuring words, and your offer of help. I will need all that you can give. The fate is indeed fickle. A year ago at this time, I was in a position as a member of the Supreme Court to make decisions for and binding on Chairman Ferguson as a lawyer. And just a few months ago, the Chancellor of the University System was the Vice President for Academic Affairs here, and at least theoretically, he had lesser authority than the President. Now the tables have turned, and you see where I am in relation to them. But it's a delightful position to be in, and I'm grateful for it, and grateful to be a partner with them in the cause of the promotion of education in this state and at this institution. A word, if I may, about this inaugural ceremony. It's been planned and executed somewhat differently than tradition dictates, in that the central figures on the platform listed in your program are those who will determine and are determining the future of education in this state and at this institution. Our faculty walk in the procession today as members of the faculty of this institution and not as representatives of other institutions, as is usually the case. Some will say that this break with tradition might add a parochial flavor to an institution that has as one of its stated goals greater national ranking. But on the contrary, I say to you that it's recognition of the hard and lasting fact that the high standing and merit of this institution will come not as a result of blind adherence to tradition, and not because of inviting representatives of the more than 2,000 institutions in this nation to be here, but rather because of what you, the faculty at this institution, are willing to do by way of commitment, dedication, and achievement, and by way of the citizens of the state of Florida and their leaders, what they give to us in furtherance of the cause that we serve. What others think of this institution is important, but what we here and the citizens who support of us think of it will be determinative of our success. Few of you can appreciate the tremendous effort required to arrange this ceremony and the events which surround it. It's a tremendous effort. I'm very grateful to all who have contributed to it, to its success. The renowned speakers who participated here, Dean Weimer and the members of his steering committee, Vice President Connor, and in the advisory committee, the University Women's Club, the Gainesville Chamber of Commerce, College of Architecture and Fine Arts for the Fine Art Exhibition, Pinafore last night, excellent production, and the Chamber Orchestra Concert this evening, the entire Gator Band, finest in the land, the Wright Union staff, the maintenance staff, the student ushers, the newly formed Cicerones, the host of others who participated in this, to make this the glorious day that it is for this institution and particularly for the O'Connells. Thank you. This is a difficult, trying time in the history of our country and of this institution. I regard it as an exhilarating period of exciting promise, and I'm very happy to be a part of it. We must make the most of it, demonstrating the courage to try the new and the wisdom to do it well, preserving all the while the best of the old and the true as those who have built before us. No generation, of course, as all of us know, can start from scratch. Fortunately, this institution does not. We stand where we are, that enjoy the quality we have achieved, because in succession, President Sled, Murphy, Tigert, Miller, and Rice, their faculties and staff and the people of this state cared enough to do enough to see that we did move forward and upward. And today we're able to stand taller, to reach higher, to achieve more, and to aspire to even greater heights because we stand upon their shoulders. Each of these great men and their faculties dealt with or mastered or ameliorated problems as great in their time as those we face today. This state, but particularly we here who are the principal beneficiaries of their labor, their love, and their wisdom, owe each of them an everlasting debt and vote of gratitude. And I'm happy that President Murphy's family or members of it are here, that Mrs. Tiger and her daughter Mary Jane, Mrs. J. Hillis Miller, and you, President Rice, are here so that what I have said and what all of us feel can be shared with you. No one can fully appreciate the present, the progress it represents, the hope for the future that it offers, without understanding or at least looking at the past. To those who doubt that great progress in every way has been made here on this campus, reminisce with me, if you will, for a moment. 50 years ago, President Murphy's University of Florida had an enrollment of 470 students, only 31 in graduate work, and a faculty of 41 members. In that year, 1918, he spent a total of $217,350 to operate this institution. 10 years later, in 1928, President Tigert presided over a University of Florida of 2,105 students and expended $1,062,000. By 1938, student enrollment had reached 3,311, the faculty about 400, each of whom earned just a little more than the students who were working their way through college in those days. It was not unusual for the faculty to write home for money. Expenditures here from that year were just over $2 million. And in 1948, President Miller had 10,143 war-weary students and a budget of almost $8 million. In the next 10 years, enrollment increased modestly to 12,304 in 1958, but the budget tripled to almost $24 million, explained in part by the great medical complex, which proudly bears the name of President Miller, whose vision, planning, and irresistible motion made it a reality, and in part explained by the growing expansion in our graduate and research programs. Then, in the succeeding 10 years, you know, Dr. Reitz was here for 12 fine years, and 9 of the last 10 years was under the skillful and dedicated leadership of that great Floridian and great man. We reached today, in 1968, with 20,180 students, of about 3,000 of which are in graduate work, more than 2,000 excellent faculty members, and a budget of almost $80 million, of which more than 50% comes from other than state tax sources. This, of course, does not tell the whole story. When I arrived as a freshman in 1934, all that was required was a certificate of graduation from a high school and about $30 to pay a semester to pay the cost of tuition and fees. All who came were welcome and accepted. This year, some 7,000 applications were made for the 2,800 vacancies or spots that we had in the freshman class. at least 80% of those accepted were in the top 20% of their high school classes. In the last 10 years, the percentage of graduate students scoring above the national median on the graduate record examination increased from 35% in 1957 to 60% in 1967, and the number of graduate students has more than doubled in the last 7 years. We are as good here today in many ways as can be found anywhere, and we're anywhere, and we're making steady progress in all of the areas in which we operate. When freshman O'Connell walked these grounds in 1934, the campus extended from the stables on the west to the law building on the east, bounded by Stadium Road immediately to the south of us and University Avenue on the north. The building numbered only about 40. Today, our inventory of buildings totals 703. The spread of this campus here is easy to see. But more important, it is spread across this state with agricultural and home economics extension and research programs in 66 of the 67 counties. Graduate engineering programs at Daytona, Cape Kennedy, Orlando, West Palm Beach, and Fort Lauderdale. A center for continuing education and a hospital education program in Jacksonville, plus continuing education programs in a number of counties in our state. Last month, our library and the city of Orlando's library were connected electronically so as to provide rapid exchange by photocopy of our tremendous collections here and those there. And very soon, our medical center will have terminals in four cities in Florida, enabling physicians there to call upon our experts for immediate assistance in medical matters. Our campus has indeed spread across this state. Our past accomplishments ought to give us confidence in and hope for the future. They are a prelude to what this university might yet become. But however commendable our past is, we can neither live on it or in it if this institution is to fully realize its place as a great university in this modern world. The function of the university in the modern world is as difficult of the exact definition as is the university's full performance of the impossible and many times conflicting burdens which have been thrust upon it by the conditions and demands of this world. Our university is at once called upon to transmit to the student today's vast knowledge to enable him to live effectively in the present, and simultaneously and hopefully to equip him to accommodate to a future which the extension of knowledge created by our own research efforts makes unpredictable even for the most clairvoyant. Add to this the ever-increasing demands by all segments of our society for service, the demonstration of the most effective use of knowledge by its application, which we as centers of knowledge and learning have proved so well that we can render. It seems inevitable, too, that as an aspect of service, the competent minds at this university and others will be called upon increasingly to be a constructive critic of the forms, the forces, and the operations which govern our lives in this mass society, which seems to be our destiny. Thus, the universities today find themselves on the horns of a dilemma of increasing demands, created not by their failures, but by their successes in extending knowledge, rendering service, and producing through educational reforms and training of better teachers an ever-increasing wave of young people capable of benefiting and needing higher education to be effective. The university is simultaneously criticized for becoming too large and also for taking too few students, that its curriculum is too specialized and practical, and that its programs are irrelevant to today's needs, that it is impersonal, and also that it is overprotective, that it devotes both too much and too little of its faculty to research, pure or applied, that it should become more involved in, and also that it should refrain from meddling in the social problems of the community, that it should put more and less emphasis on graduate programs, that we must shorten requirements and time required to obtain degrees, and at the same time that we must increase them to accommodate to the increase in knowledge, that we should lower our standards to admit the disadvantaged, and that we should continually raise them to guarantee excellence in our students. And we are pressured on the one hand to move our students more rapidly through the curriculum, and on the other, to afford more time, the student more time for the leisured study and reflection that makes learning a delightful experience. Quite obviously, the university cannot do all that everyone asks of it, nor can it be all things to all people. At best, as Clark Kerr has pointed out, the university is so many things to so many different people that it must, of necessity, be partially at war with itself. Because we here are so broad-gauged in all of our programs, academic research, and service, I'm told that we're only one of three out of the more than 2,000 institutions that have on one campus the wide range of disciplines that are found here. Because of all of this, the dilemma of the university, all of the conflicting criticisms of it, and Kerr's observation apply to, are heard, and must be dealt with forthrightly by this institution. Already we have outgrown the careful plans made only yesteryear. We must begin anew to set new goals, develop new plans, establish new priorities and projections of needs and resources, and agree upon courses of action to achieve them. No single authority, president, governor, or regent, no single group, faculty, student, administrator, or the public we serve, should or will make the decisions that must guide our future. Our problems and our future belong to all of these, and by utilizing the combined efforts, leadership, and wisdom of all, we can and we shall reach a consensus based firmly on a sense of necessity, duty, and obligation. But if we on this campus, as we contend we are capable of aiding and shaping the world without we ought to be, and we must on this campus be the originators of whatever process is necessary to determine our goals and the action that must be taken. If we do not do this, then others will do it for us. An institution is an entity can have no goals and make no meaningful commitments apart from those that are held by the human beings that give it life and its direction. Therefore, its faculty, its students, its staff, its governing board, and the citizenship it serves must make the meaningful commitment and must make the goals. Chief among these groups is the faculty. For in the beginning and in the end, it is the individual faculty member's dedication, determination, and proficiency that determines just how well we do what we do. And it is with the faculty, then, that our search for a consensus in goals must begin. This, I'm told, is an undertaking fraught with peril as much as it is difficult of achievement, because of the wide diversification and conflict of views held by faculty both as to personal and institutional goals as well as to value of programs. And yet this is a risk that we must take and a difficulty we must face forthrightly. Only this way can we accomplish that sharing of interest and goals between individual and institution that must prevail if we are to convince that it will be through the realization of the goals of this institution that the individual can gain the achievement of greatest personal satisfaction. That dedication must be to the welfare and progress of this university as well as to discipline and department. Of course, the administration must be accorded his place rightfully in the formulation and the guidance of the aspirations of this institution. The university exists not merely to serve the student, but for a cause: the preservation, transmission, application, and critical evaluation of knowledge. And the student must be convinced that he is here to enlist and to participate fully in that cause. And he must be given the opportunity to do so. We do not fully involve him in it. All that we shall have accomplished here is to have taught him how to eat, but not how to cook. The citizens, the many publics we serve and upon whom we are dependent for the resources, the support, and the encouragement without which we would have no future, must be encouraged and consulted as to help us develop and meet our plans. And we must convince the people of this state and our leaders that we exist only to serve their needs, and that it only if we reach our goals can theirs be realized. Our first goal then, and it is one that is very personal to me, must be to create an atmosphere of trust and understanding, a complicity of purpose and objectives between faculty, student, administrator, and citizen that will enlist the active participation of all in the continuing process of discussion and decision-making necessary to a new definition for our reason for existence and the course that we must follow. A process that must utilize effectively the leadership, the wisdom, and the abilities of all, give predominance to none, yet evoke the resolve, the dedication, the support, and the commitment of each to the progress on the road that we must travel. The second step, easily stated, to define our goals, starting with a recognition that while each university shares some objectives with all others, each is and must be distinctive in character and purpose, that no one institution can be all thing to all constituencies, that while the opportunities for our service are unlimited, our resources will always be. And therefore, we must determine what roles we are playing and must play in our future. As I have said, we have long outgrown the generous projection of growth set for us, the long-range plans, the goals, the objectives carefully prescribed by Presidents Tiger, Miller, and Wright, have either been or are being achieved in whole or in part. We've reached another plateau in our proud history. We must chart another new course, or wallow in tracks already traveled, walk again furrows already well plowed, and ultimately drift aimlessly into disunity and disarray, performing only the familiar and not that essential and necessary to our progress. This definition of goals, the establishment of priorities, the sculpture of the plan of action, is the most difficult job that I can foresee. Nothing will try the creativity, the patience, and the stamina of all here more than will this. None of this can be done without an organization adequate in academic and administrative affairs, in both design, function, and personnel to do the job. An expert, after studying our administrative organization recently, observed that this university was, and I quote him, the most overregulated and under-administered he had ever seen. I cannot confirm or deny that we're overregulated, but I do know that we are under-administered in several of the critical areas of need, from department to the top level of administration. And as a consequence, all that we do in many instances is to react and respond rather than to foresee for the future. We have simply outgrown our administrative organization and staffing, and we must fit it. This is a personal goal for me, and one that's done in the hope of better serving you. My short experience here indicates that this institution is on a sound, constructive course, that our students are as good as most and better than many. Our faculty are as good as can be found in any institution of this size, that most persons on this campus are committed to the constant improvement of what we do and how we do it. But we are too good not to be much better. And one of the surest ways of becoming better is to undertake a frank self-assessment, self-evaluation of ourselves and our efforts as individuals and as an institution, and then honestly face up to and act decisively on what we find. We need to ask ourselves again and again, what kind of a product is it that we're trying to turn out, and how well we're succeeding? Are the courses we teach the right ones? How many are obsolete, and what ones should we be teaching that we are not? Are we teaching too many, spreading our resources too thin? Have we actually acknowledged the presence of women students on our campus in our curriculum? Is what we do in the educational process properly transferring the burden of learning to the student as it must? Or are we instructing too much and inspiring too little? Is what we do designed to instill conscience, morality, and culture, as well as competence? Just how well are we teaching what we teach? Are we using teaching aids effectively? And just how well are we rewarding excellence in teaching? Is it not high time for us to institute a method of evaluating the effectiveness of teaching for the benefit of the individual as well as a basis for determining advancement? Are we neglecting the undergraduate and devoting too much time, too much of our resources, too much of our skilled teachers to research and the graduate student? Is there a proper relationship between our graduate, between our academic mission and our research? Are we using too much of what we have simply to serve the business world? Is our counseling as bad as students contend, and are as faculty as inaccessible as the student feels? All of us as impersonal, as insensitive to the needs of the student as is so widely proclaimed? Are many of our rules and regulations, academic and non-academic, outmoded, unreasonable, and unnecessary, as so many argue? Is the honor system ineffective, and is honor dead in the minds and hearts of our students? Is student government no longer representative of the student on this campus? Is the administration the dictator that it is charged to be? Is the university senate not representative of the faculty or unable to act effectively? Should this institution become involved in the affairs of the community as an instrument of social action? And if so, who then will carry out the mission of objective free thought and education? Are we doing our part to aid the disadvantaged but capable student? And conversely, should we not extend our honors program for the better student? The process is a difficult one. It may be dangerous, but we cannot avoid facing, frankly, the dangers and hardships that confront us on the road to progress. Here, in what I, the questions that I have outlined, is a demonstration, a protest, that all can join and hail as a constructive effort, and one that I would pledge to lead. One in which we can and we will protest against ineffective and uninteresting teaching wherever it exists. In which we will wage war on the impersonality and discourtesy of students as well as teacher and staff, in which we will require reason and logic to be shown for our policies, rules, and regulations, in which we will treat inefficiency as waste, as an evil that must be rooted out and cured, and obsolescence as dead wood that must be removed to make room for new growth. I ask that all of you join me in this movement, in this protest, in this kind of a demonstration. It will require that we reject the position of those who would maintain the status quo and equally that of those who propose radical reformation by destruction, and instead adoption of the course which, through evolution in which we build with new bricks on already firm foundations, a university with a new look, a new outlook through windows which open into the future and into the modern world. Many views about the role that a president will play and should play. Many of you have different views. Some say he must be an innovator and an initiator, and I would hope to do some of both. But more important, I think, that it is my task to create that climate here that will encourage the faculty, the administration, and the students to initiate and to innovate and to reward them for doing, to assist in obtaining the resources to make it possible. Others say that the president must be a conciliator and a referee, and to some extent he must. But he must be more. He must, and I will constantly strive to convince all in this state and you on this campus that this institution is designed to be, is capable of, and will achieve true distinction in your day and in mine. That objectives which would seem impossible today will be possible tomorrow. And that we will be the best in the South, second to none in the nation. Presidents must make decisions. I learned long ago that most often greater damage is done by failure to decide than by making the wrong one. I cannot guarantee that I will offer complete solutions or make the right decisions in our problems. I pledge only to you that each issue will be faced up to and decided in a responsible, informed, and forthright manner, after getting the best of the facts and the greatest counsel that all of you can offer. The most important function, one of if not, is that I must and you must interpret to the citizens of this state what this institution is doing and how well it is doing it, what it must do in the future, what the needs are in this state for our product, what it will cost for us to meet these needs. And we have many needs, including air conditioning in the gym. And telling the people of this state what the consequences will be if our needs and theirs are not met. We have the necessity to convince the business world and the sources of private funds that we are in need of and worthy of their help. We must convince all that this university is uniquely different from the others in our system, that it has achieved a degree of distinction and a breadth of purpose that requires that we be treated differently in the legislative halls and at the budget table if we are to continue to achieve and progress as we should and must. We must be careful, all of us in this state, that in what we do, that we do not enforce mediocrity on all the universities, including this one, in the process of building a system. This would be tragic for all. Faith is essential to service in and support of any cause. Because of the destructive actions of a few on college campuses across our land, many of our citizens have lost and are losing faith in higher education as the best way to ensure progress in our society. They have serious misgivings about the young people of our day. We must not lose our faith, either in our young people or in the educational process. And all of us must do that which is necessary to cause others to reaffirm their faith as well as ours. The true significance of this occasion, as I view it, is that as educators, as students, as scholars, and as friends of education, we have met here today to reaffirm our faith in the pursuit of knowledge and those who pursue it, young and old. It is reassuring to me to know that all of you have not lost faith in education, in this institution, or in me. I have not lost mine. It has been strengthened in the 11 months that I have been here. John Erskine described the life of a president as being like walking on a picket fence, thrilling